Good evening, everybody. Thanks for being here. I was appreciating, as I often do, the great virtues and challenges of our sort of complicated arrangements tonight. Appreciating that people are, and more diversity of people is, are doing the ringing of bells and announcing of chanting, thanks to Kate's organizing. Cajoling, maybe. And just that, you know, it's interesting, you know, because we've inherited the system that's quite a bit more than just support for meditation. There's meditation in the center, and kind of that's where we come back to. But then we've surrounded it by this fairly involved series of roles and tasks and things to do, you know. And the thing I want to say about all that is that, you know, as you're ready, these are really helpful, you know, aspects of Zen practice. And that you don't do these roles, unlike the way we tend to think about these things, you do not get to do these roles because you're, like, good at it. It's because it's, you know, for one reason or another, seems appropriate, or you seem ready, or we just need the help, you know, we ask you. And then you just show up in that role, you know, and you just do your best, and whatever happens is included, you know, actually is Zen training. So including publicly making, you know, mistakes, if that's what you do, or being so tense about never making mistakes and no one knows how tense you are, if that's what you do, you know, whatever you do is included. And everything is that way, you know, so I was just appreciating that tonight is the last night in quite a while. We will have our other brave ordained members, Chris and Edie, Shudo and, I should know.
Shuko
and Shudo, cool. Yeah, you're right. Because they're going off to the Zen monastery in California for a 3-month version of tonight, where you just stay there and you just do this training, nothing else to do. And so even, you know, up to ordaining as a priest, it's the same way, you know. You don't ordain because you're, like, going to be good at it. How would you know that you're going to be good at it? Somehow you have a calling and you show up and the circumstances are right and you just do your best. So that's what we do. And even if just coming to sit is more than enough, then that's great too, you know. That's also doing an important role, essential role. So you don't have to do all this stuff either, but it's available, you know. Part of the thing. So not to think that it's like the window dressing. It's a very integrated, kind of integrated situation. Other Sangha notes. Bob Penny took off with 7 pilgrims. They're gonna do like a 80-90 mile silent hike around the Three Sisters peaks in Oregon, somewhere near Mount Hood. I don't even know exactly where it is. And they'll do daily meditation practice, and he's going to try to give some reflections on the three treasures as they go around the Three Sisters. Mm. It's kind of cool. So they're off. Bob, Georgia, Jaron, you know, a couple of the members of the Seattle Sangha, so that's a nice inter-sangha thing. Leslie Dalaba, Sergey, and another person who just heard about this somehow through the grapevine and flew up from California to be a part of that experience, yeah. So that's good. I'm grateful that that gets to happen. Bob is really great in that role. And another Sangha note, Connie Martin, our member, we don't get to see her very often. But lately the reason we don't see her is that she's having really terrible health problems. So if you know Connie and have time to send her a note on the email or a card, some kind of real debilitating back issue with lots and lots of pain, and, you know, really sounds very serious. Nancy's been living at her place, helping her out. And there are probably some other Sangha notes. Oh yeah, here's one more. We were working on sewing. Here's another like role we take on, is the wearing of the, taking the precepts and the wearing of the rakasu, wearing this bib-like thing. It's a kind of like a confirmation or something like that. I don't know what it is in English. Receiving the precepts. Anyway, some people are preparing to do that, and there's a whole process of preparation. And Chris brought forward a great suggestion about that process. So the people who are going to go through the ceremony have to sew the rakasu, but then the rakasu also goes in a little envelope. And she recommended, it's a great idea, what if the people who have previously done this ceremony, if they have time and ability and interest, could sew the envelopes for the next group? Isn't that a nice idea? Mm-hmm. So you could like have a buddy that you're making one for, you know, and you could pick fabric for them. So anyway, if you're interested in that, talk to me and I'll try to hook you up with Susan Elvey, or we'll figure it out together. There are I think five are going to be ready at the time, maybe six. So a few Sangha notes. So continuing the topic of Prajnaparamita, this wisdom that has a different basis from the wisdom that we usually think about, which is important teaching in this school. I thought we would appreciate some words from Meizumi Roshi about Prajnaparamita, one of our founding Japanese in America teachers. Meizumi Roshi started the Zen Center of Los Angeles and had many powerful American disciples who started centers and monasteries and entire orders all over the place. I never met him, nor studied with him a little bit. One time he was giving a talk and he said something about Prajnaparamita. I kind of opened the book at random. There it was. So when we say Mahaprajna, it always means absolute, transcendent. That's how it can be translated. But I don't like this word transcendent. It is not transcendental or transcendent, but very, very real. Very realistic. See? A real and matter-of-fact thing. That's what Dogen Zenji says. Anything, everything is prajna, wisdom. 100 grasses, literally. Concrete floor, see? Point the floor. Lectern, paper holder, rug, ceiling, you, your robe, your hair, nose, tongue, body, all kinds of thoughts, all kinds of so-called processes of your mind or consciousness. All these things are nothing but that. Maha prajna, great prajna. Then what is paramita? All of you, again, know what I mean, right? They're probably, huh? Reach to the other shore, and not in the sense of sometime in the future. Reach to the other shore, but not in the sense of sometime in the future. You are already on that. You're already on that shore. That's what paramita means. You have gone already. You have reached. You have realized. It is not in the past or present, but in perfect tense. Have reached. So, Maha Prajnaparamita means that wisdom has revealed now as not only just you, but as the life of anything, everything. We are living it. We are being lived by it. That's what Maha Prajnaparamita means. That is what Avalokitesvara Bodhisattva does. And he's referring to the Heart Sutra, which mentions Avalokitesvara Bodhisattva. So it's everything. I guess probably we can find a recording online or something, but I think Meizumi Roshi was one of these Japanese speakers who never learned English that thoroughly, and so the way the person editing the book to try to make it intelligible decided to make the whole book in verse. So it's all verse, all each line is centered, so it's actually really hard to read. Yeah. That's the only way she could figure out, I suppose, to make it intelligible. So Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind is that way too. Like, it seems like a reasonably intelligible book, but you can actually read the transcripts online of the original talks, which don't make quite as much sense. So it's interesting. How do we communicate, you know? Prajnaparamita. That's how we communicate. So Prajnaparamita is this wisdom that's everywhere, and it doesn't depend on permanence, doesn't depend on being right, doesn't depend on being solid. And these last 2 weeks we've been discussing that it's a wisdom with a basis in a more sort of full and accurate understanding of the nature of reality. that we have some fundamental ways that we assume reality to be, even though we know better, that aren't quite right. And we reflected that one way to think about reality as sort of corrective for our misapprehension of reality are the Buddha's three marks. So one more time, maybe the last time for now, to review those three marks. Come on in. So, anicca, impermanence, dukkha, stress, or unsatisfactoriness, my current favorite, awkward, but more accurate, unsatisfactoriness. And I got a new one for anatta. Instead of not-self, I thought maybe we should say no abiding self. No self that just sort of is stable and abiding. And we were saying these all make sense in a theoretical kind of way, and you know, we've successfully memorized a list of three, I hope, good job, but are only really useful if we can bring them to mind when we catch ourselves acting as if things were the exact opposite of this, right? When we're expecting permanence, when we're expecting some kind of lasting satisfaction from transient things, when we're expecting a very solid and supported and, you know, praised, you know, sort of self, right? And this last is easy to misunderstand, right? We're not saying that we should not have love and support. Of course, we should have love and support. But how do we hold it, you know? Or how do we let go of it? Okay. So then, later Buddhism said, well, wait a minute. They said, if you're saying things are not permanent, are you saying that there are things? And if you're saying that nothing gives lasting satisfaction, is there some thing there that gives unlasting satisfaction? Or what do you mean? You know, and what is this self that you think is not there? So later Buddhist philosophers and practitioners thought, maybe we need to look a little more deeply into this idea of, you know, what is reality and what would be helpful, what would be a good balm, you know, good healing for us when we cling so tightly to things other than the way they are. And so they came up with another concept, which we've talked about before. They came up with this concept of shunyata, which is usually translated as emptiness. And for those of you in scholarly bent, the Sanskrit sha sound is a little bit confusing because the scholarly transliteration of the Sanskrit character, they do S with a little uptick like that. I forget the name of that macron or something. And then other times, if they're not using the little bit diacriticals, they use SH. So you might see something that's a sha sound written like that, or SH like we would expect. So shunya ta. So shunya means zero. Nothing, empty. And the ta is a modifier that makes it into an adjective. So zeroness, you know, nothingness, emptiness. So it is not a noun. That's important. Because we're so concrete, right? We make everything into a something, right? And as we're going to explore a little bit, this is a concept that there's nothing that can be made into a something, and yet we would want to make that into a something too. Like, okay, well, at least I know it's emptiness, you know? There's nothing here, but it's emptiness. That's good, you know? And people talk about having an experience of emptiness and studying emptiness as if it was a something to study. Right? And I talk that way sometimes too, sorry. So since it's an adjective, it's describing. So it's describing, in this case, reality. And it's saying that reality is empty of something. So what it's empty of is a word for which there is no real equivalent word in English. Because we don't get this. So we don't even have a word for it in our language, right? That tells you something about the, you know, because language kind of controls in some way what we can understand with our cognition, right? So what it's empty of, I left it blank so I could unveil this great teaching now. You excited? Mm-hmm. What it's empty of is... I'm having fun with the Sanskrit and Pali. I hope it doesn't drive me nuts, but I'm having fun with it. The word in Sanskrit is svabhava. It's empty of svabhava. Good to know, huh? There's no svabhava here. So what svabhava means, one translation that's used is own being, and we just chanted that. Did you hear that word, own being? We said, I wrote a quote in here, that in the homage to the perfection of wisdom, she fully understands the own being of all dharmas. Yeah, I lost the exact quote, but. And another translation, which maybe is a little more helpful, is, what was it? I'm going out of order on my notes. I continue to be in denial about the reading glasses thing, according to my behavior, because I don't bring them. That's okay. It usually just confuse me. I gotta bring one. Yeah, we're already confused enough. No, that's okay. So another translation of svabhava is intrinsic nature. Something about things that is sort of like built into them or consistent or like true in some way. And so the idea of emptiness is to try to free us from this sort of fixing of things with our concepts, our sort of implying something sort of real and stable, you know, which it seems like was already handled by impermanence, but they're trying to go a little deeper than that. They help us to see little by little that all designations, all concepts are temporary and approximate, and that nothing can be quite nailed down. John, can you do me a favor and hand me that box in the corner?
Yeah.
I was feeling like an astronaut earlier. Everyone was bringing me stuff in my capsule here. Yeah. Okay, thank you. So we would say that the lid of this box is blue, right? We would say this has sort of nature of blueness, right? We would say that it's blue. And of course it's blue. But there are many blues. Which blue do we mean? And what is this experience of blue exactly? There's something happening with light and eyes and our brain and the way we describe colors and what we were taught as a kid. Blue, 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 right? It's like the funnest thing, right? Programming our children into the exact opposite understanding of this, right? From an early age, you know? That's blue. Oh, okay. But what does that mean exactly? And what if somebody in the room were colorblind, like really colorblind, and you can't necessarily tell green from blue? So what if I said to the colorblind person, green, green? They would agree, right? Looks just like everything else they were told was green. So is it blue or is it green? And we can also see that it's like a blue plastic. Somehow, isn't that interesting? We could tell that right away, right? Plastic man. Kind of cheap, you know. Came from Walmart, actually. Literally. Worse. This has bad intrinsic nature. They don't pay their people anyway. And is it the same blue as a blue wall or a blue car or any other blue object? It's the same as if it were metal. Would it be the same blue as blue metal? And so the idea is that anything we try to sort of describe or affix to anything, you know, if we think about it long enough, it gets a little slippery, which all sounds a little silly. I mean, who cares? It's a blue pin, right? But where it gets more problematic, you know, and where we create suffering is that we do the same things to ourselves, right? And to others. we affix characteristics and qualities and descriptions to people. I am this kind of person, you are that kind of person. And of course the three marks help with this. You know, we can remember that everyone's changing, it's impermanent, you know, that it's silly to try to sort of manipulate people and we're in relationship with and to try to behave in the way we want them to behave so we'll feel good, right? We know it's not going to work. You know that, right? It doesn't work. And so the three marks around suffering and impermanence and the sort of effervescence of self help us, but this is going further, an even more powerful medicine. And sometimes they say, you know, in traditional teachings, they say we got to make sure everyone's ready before you give the Prajnaparamita teachings. So I didn't really, like, check you out. So I'm just on faith here. I know everybody, you know, pretty much, so it's probably okay. Because this is seen, maybe. Just try to limit your exposure. So seen is powerful medicine because it's a negation of our whole conceptual frame. But remember, like we were saying last week, the no is a different kind of negation than we're used to, because the negation we're used to is within a very sort of yes-no reality. This is a negation that's intended to soften, to open, and to awaken us to the flexibility and, you know, interpenetration and constant shifting of all categories and qualities. They sometimes say in the Zen koan literature that ordinarily people have a lot of dust in their eyes. Just telling somebody this. That, you know, ordinarily we can kind of see what's going on, but there's a lot of dust, you know. Like our sort of self-concept and our not understanding this kind of distorts our view. And this leaps to the fore, right, when we have problems, especially problems with other people, we can see, oh, God. And maybe the whole room here, you know, is full of, like, swirling dust. We're all sort of squinting a little bit, you know, like, what's he saying? What? And the idea is that the emptiness teachings radically clear the air. Dust vanishes. And it's understood that when we can sort of feel some harmony with emptiness or some connection to these teachings, it's like we can see clearly, as if for the first time, like, wow, look at these people, oh my goodness, you know. And once in a while we have an experience like that. I think every one of us has experiences like that. And sometimes they're way back in childhood and we forgot about them. And it's not the worst thing once in a while to recall these experiences to mind. Those moments, you know, when, like we mentioned this last week, when things are just like, it could be a really beautiful aesthetic experience, maybe, you know, sunset, really seeing a flower, or something more ordinary, just a feeling like, oh, you know, everything's okay. Huh. Quickly the mind's like, but it's not really, you know, but, you know, that feeling. And the powerful negation that we talked about last week in chapter 1 of the Prajnaparamita Sutra in 8,000 lines, which you can listen online if you weren't here or you forgot about it, is like really good news, is the way it's understood. It's clear as the dust if we can handle it. That there are no bodhisattvas, that there are no beings with problems and beings with great aspirations in the way that we think there are, and that there is no Prajnaparamita and no Buddhism and no bodhisattvas who understand this, and the bodhisattvas who can appreciate this, who can practice with this knowledge that there's nothing solid, you know, and not freak out. There was a long description about how you're not supposed to freak out. These are the ones, you know. These are the ones who can offer these teachings to the world and be of benefit to the world. So I thought we'd do a little exercise. I'm going to... So who knows if this will work? We'll try it. So when you get the little bin with the purportedly blue lid, reach inside and take an object, and don't really look at it. Just take an object and hold on to it. Okay? And let's try to do that kind of quick so we can get everybody an object. Now you have a special Dharma treasure. You got two? Oh. Hey, don't look at it. Just hold on to it. Just hold it. Feel. So just feeling the feeling of that object in your hands. And seeing if you can touch into just the actual sensations on the palm, on the fingers, as best you can, not trying to give the object a name or a category, or figure out why I'm doing this. Breathing. And then noticing if the mind is constructing images. We kind of often can't help it. The mind constructs some image of what this object is. You've got a glimpse of it too. What's happening in the mind as you hold the object and are curious about it? And now look at your object. Just for a couple of seconds, just take a little look at it, like you usually just kind of look at things, you look carefully. Good. Now cover it up again. Good. Hold on to it again. Okay. Now, visualize in your mind, you can close your eyes if you want, as specifically as you can, exactly what does your object look like? What are the shapes, colors, you know? What exactly is that thing you're holding? In a visual way. See if you can visualize it. What are you forgetting? And now, let's look at it again, but this time really hold it up, you know, get it at a good focal distance for your poor eyes, you know. Put on your glasses. And now let's really study it as if it was the most important and interesting thing you ever held, you know, a beautiful gem or something. Really look carefully at it, stabilize the body, and just really let the totality of your attention and interest be in the visual field, looking in detail at your object. And now notice what name, you've already given your object a name probably, you can't help it. Maybe other comments, but just to notice what name you gave the object and keep looking. Keep looking at your object, really keep looking, longer than you feel like it. And what have you noticed about your object that you didn't notice at first? Ask that question. And now, see if you can see the space in and around the object. See if you can focus on the absence of the object. So you got the object and all around it is non-object, right? Maybe in the middle of it are areas that are not the object. See if you can focus on that space. Good. Now, and this one's the most creative, imagine that you are the object, and you are the object looking up at your face. What do you see now? So really try to imagine this. You thought the object was some object over there, but maybe the object is you looking at you. Who knows? Yeah. Okay, enough of that. You're released. Did you get at least an interesting little toy or fragment or something? That's our little bin we hand out to toddlers. You know, come over. So in one, many different systems of Buddhism have in tremendous texts and studies of emptiness, not just the Prajnaparamita texts. And I was reading a little bit about a Tibetan system called Mahamudra. Tibetan Buddhism is very complicated, I don't know that much about it. But I ran into this thing about emptiness in Mahamudra, and they say there are 6 wrong views that come from not understanding emptiness. So I thought we would see whether we noticed any of these 6 wrong views when we were studying our plastic toy. The first wrong view is permanence. So that lines up with the first mark. So did your perception of the object stay the same the whole time, or did your perception change at all?
Changed.
So there was impermanence in the act of studying your plastic object. Okay, so permanence is the first one. The second misunderstanding is that I can control my experience. I can control my experience. So did you have total control of the experience of studying your object? Or were there any things that, well, I guess the change suggests not, but any surprises or things that didn't seem like you were really controlling the situation, like your object was part of the equation or something like this? Yes? Okay.
I thought this was a triangle.
Yeah?
But when I looked at it from the side, it became a big fat yellow line.
Okay, you wanted to be a triangle and you were not able to control the triangleness of the experience. Okay, the third misunderstanding. So the first was permanence. The second was that we can control experience. So of course we can reflect on these in daily life. The third is we're at the mercy of external forces and have no control. So these are 2 extreme views, right? One, I have no control. 2, I have total control. So I guess that's essentially the same question, right? So it sounds like that was the case. That you neither had total control nor were you totally controlled by your object, right? You had some influence. The fourth misunderstanding of emptiness, according to this system, and I'm probably terribly paraphrasing this teaching, is that things are exactly as we perceive them and no other way. Things are exactly as we perceive them and no other way. So again, change in our perception of our toy over time seems to suggest that things are not necessarily exactly the way we see them, that there's something more fluid going on. So that's the first one, fourth one. And the fifth are a pair. Fifth and sixth are a pair, sorry. Number 5 is the reality of experience is coming from the outside. The reality of experience is coming from the outside. And 6 is the reality of experience is coming only from the inside. So which is it? Did the colors and shapes and form of the plastic toy create reality? Or did your mind and the different things I suggested that you do and different ways of looking at it and perceiving with different senses, did that create reality? What do you think?
Both.
Both, yeah. Both, okay. So the essential point here is that there's a complex dance going on, right? And that we sort of make things concrete and fixed in a certain way that's so not the case that we need a concept that negates all concept to kind of help us, you know, to nudge us away, to try to cure us. But all dharmas, and dharma here is a technical term that's worth learning because it's going to show up in our sutra in spades. Dharma, especially when it's written in English with a small d, dharma, Sanskrit word, means experience. Anything that can be seen, felt, thought about, any moment or unit of experience. And the dance here between the 3 marks and emptiness is that the earlier Buddhists felt like there are these things, dharmas. You know, I mean, they're not me, they're not satisfactory, they're impermanent, they're changing, you know, they're woven together and constructing more complex objects all the time and dissolving and falling apart again. But there are things called dharmas. And they made various lists of them that are very interesting. And later Buddhism said, no, dharmas are empty too. Dharmas have no essential essence, no svabhava. So there's nothing really that makes a car, makes a blue lid, makes me, makes you, you. It's just everything's coming together in some pattern, some configuration, and has already changed. Not that it's going to change, and has already changed. Oh, here's the quote from the thing we chanted. She has a clear knowledge of the own being of all dharmas, for she does not stray away from it. Remember chanting that? She has a clear knowledge of the own being of all dharmas, for she does not stray away from it. So the clear knowledge is that there is no own being, that dharmas are empty of it. And this investigating the own being of dharmas matters. So we're not now not just going to like check out, right? We need to actively investigate the emptiness of dharmas. And how do we know about the emptiness of dharmas? We notice the many ways that we try to fix them, right? In position and make them into something. And we notice the results of that, right? What happens when we do that? So Prajnaparamita, in its fullest description here, is the wisdom that rests in this, that rests in emptiness, which is to say, nowhere to rest. So the great Western translator of these sutras, unbelievable guy, and I hope we'll have time to talk a little about his biography later. Edward Kanza was his name. He died in the 1980s, I think. He summed it up this way. And here's a guy. He was not, I'll say a little bit about him. He was not a trained Buddhist practitioner. Didn't even have really much formal training as a Buddhist scholar because he was early in the Buddhist scholarship game in the West. There were very few. But he, as a young person, got interested in the Diamond Sutra. And he spent his whole life translating Prajnaparamita. He learned Sanskrit and spent his whole life, basically, on one task, translating Prajnaparamita sutras. So he knew something about this. And here's what he said, apparently. The thousands of lines of the Prajnaparamita can be summed up by the following two sentences. One should become a bodhisattva, i.e., one who is content with nothing less than the all knowledge attained through the perfection of wisdom for the sake of all beings. Sentence one. One should become a bodhisattva, become one who is content with nothing less than the all knowledge attained through the perfection of wisdom for the sake of all beings. And, sentence two. There is no such thing as a bodhisattva, or as all knowledge, or as a being, or as the perfection of wisdom, or as attainment. To accept both of these contradictory facts is to be perfect, he said. And we might fuss with some of his wording a little bit, but I think that's pretty good. So I got some home practice for you, and then we'll close. A couple of times during the next week, if you think of it, and you have a little time, and you do, actually, even if you think you're busy, just stop and perceive something. It doesn't have to be a plastic toy. It could be something else. Just really look at something. Really listen. You could practice listening meditation. That's a good practice. See if you can notice the way your mind assigns such simple, simplistic, limited labels to things, like a tree. And just stay there. Keep perceiving, you know, keep investigating. Keep noticing more and more subtle concepts and observations, perceptions. So instead of just a tree, maybe we have red and green leaves, upthrust trunk, and just keep going. Movement, space between shapes, light, reflecting, and just, you know, as much as you have time for, just keep investigating. And, you know, each of those concepts, of course, has more and more, you know, components and more subtle aspects to it. And sometimes, you know, you might have a sense of the sort of fragileness of our conceptual frame, you know, that any label you put on something, if you look carefully, isn't quite right, you know. There's five more labels that rush in, and each one of those is not quite right. And ultimately, there's nothing left, right? There's no concept left. There's just some experience of being. So that's what they mean, I think, more or less, by the emptiness of all dharmas. So see if you can, you know, play with that, you know, as experience, not just as an idea. You know, you got to hang out for 5 or 10 minutes, and going on a long meditation retreat helps this. So Chris and Edie have a 3-month homework assignment. The rest of us a week is good. Because it's a great blessing of that kind of practice, that these things just become so obvious, you know. And it's so beautiful, too. That's the other thing about this. This is not a drag, you know. This is like, wow, you know. How beautiful it is to just be with a tree, you know. And actually see a little more the nature of that experience. Okay, so that's Prajnaparamita talk 3. I was telling Talis earlier, I'm very worried and freaked out that there's nothing but talks to prepare us to study the Prajnaparamita Sutra in 8,000 lines and never actually start. I'll show you these guys. Okay, thanks very much.